Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Happiness, that elusive concept that Solomon longed for in the book of Ecclesiastes. Solomon tried various avenues to reach that destination, including education, money, power, and fame, but often found them to provide only temporary pleasure and often unexpected sorrow. Some 3,000 years later, we here in the modern world still face the same dilemmas that plagued the ancient Israeli king. We're still looking for happiness and fame, fortune and power, and becoming disappointed in the results. Heck, some of us even try to find happiness in wisdom by getting a PhD in the social sciences, realizing that usually closes the door to fame, fortune, and power. But what about faith? Can a life led spiritually, meaning participation in a religious community, regular prayer, and/or simple belief in divine guidance, lead to greater levels of happiness? To address that question, I am pleased to be joined today by Dr. G. Alexander Ross, professor of sociology at the Institute for the Psychological Sciences in Arlington, Virginia, which, for those of you who are not familiar with this institution, is a Catholic graduate school of psychology. Professor Roth is author of numerous articles, but today we're going to focus in particular on one he recently published in the Interdisciplinary Journal of Research on Religion, entitled The Impact of Church Attendance on the Decline in Female Happiness in the United States. We'll put up a link to that article on our website, which is free of charge if you just simply register for the Interdisciplinary Journal of Research on Religion. It's a great resource, and in large part, it's where we get the name of this podcast, Research on Religion. Alex, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
The first question I have to ask, and I found this out just recently, is that you are a trained sociologist, and yet you are at a graduate school of psychology. How does a sociologist end up at a graduate school of psychology?
Well, the IPS, or the Institute for Psychological Sciences, that I'm affiliated with, is, as you mentioned, it's a Catholic graduate school of psychology. It's, I think, virtually the only one in the United States fully related to this and dedicated to this approach, standalone, and it's probably there's not much else in the rest of the world. But that's what really attracted me to the school. I don't teach any of the clinical courses, of course, but I do teach social psychology. I teach a course in psychological measurement and so on. So those are areas that my training in sociology equips me for. So
now the psychologists that are there, when they see a sociologist running around the hall, they're not using you as a guinea pig at all, showing you ink blots or making you run through a maze to find some cheese, are they?
Well, they may be measuring me subliminally or something. I don't know, but I don't think so.
Okay. Are there other sociologists and other social scientists associated with that school?
Well, I'm the only non-psychologist in with social science mm-hmm. background. We do have a philosopher mm-hmm. who's on the full-time faculty, and there are also adjunct faculty from various fields.
Okay, well, I want to come back to that institute that you're working at, because I find it very fascinating. But let's go ahead and jump into the topic of happiness and start out with a basic definition here, if at all possible, and that is the ancient question of what is happiness, and then perhaps turn to the question of how do we measure it?
Right. Well, that's, of course, a profound question because it's something that we're all attracted to. We all want to be happy. Mm-hmm. And that's of course, that doesn't require modern psychology to know that. The ancients, of course, understood that. And sometimes I think their ideas about happiness were, in many cases, more profound or richer than what we tend to think of it today.
In what ways?
Well, the idea of happiness, we do, I think, in our modern thought and our approach to life, often have a fairly shallow idea of happiness. That we think about it certainly in terms of possessing things that we desire, and that, mm-hmm. of course, that's certainly a good approach. But the things that we desire often are kept in terms of material possessions and these kinds of things, and or simply a matter of pleasure and almost a hedonistic kind of approach.
Immediate gratification.
Well, sure, and happiness, if we think about it in a richer sense, certainly within the Christian tradition, we have the term beatus or something, blessed, mm-hmm. Those kinds of senses. Or joy is a word, of course, that's often talked about within Christian thought,
mm-hmm.
Is, I think, a richer, deeper, more profound sense of that which we search for,
mm-hmm.
In our lives. And of course, that again, in the Christian tradition, we have that as a promise of our Lord, that perfect blessedness, that perfect happiness that we hope for. To share with him for eternity. So, I mean, this, of course, is a much deeper sense than normally we think of when you ask a question such as, in generally, how are you these days? Would you say that you're happy, very happy, pretty happy, or not too happy? Which, of course, is that's a very common measurement of happiness today that's used in quite a few surveys, including the General Social Survey, which I used in this paper.
Yeah, so I want to get to that question. Again, I like the distinction that we have between happiness that today we think of as immediate gratification or material possessions and such, and the concept of joy, as you mentioned. We recently had a sermon at our own church about the search for joy or the mm-hmm. path toward joy, and the idea that it can become a longer-term sense of contentment, that even in difficult times, you still are at peace with the world. And again, that doesn't quite fit with what we normally think of happiness here in, you know, modern media world that we live in.
That's true. And I think a lot of that is probably caught by, or we capture it better if we introduce a sense of the reality of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Again, within Christian thought, this is very well developed, of course,
mm-hmm.
but suffering is something that in the modern world and in our more narrow conceptions of happiness, it's just totally inconsistent with that notion. And yet, and again, in the Christian understanding of that, we understand that, in fact, in many cases, suffering is necessary for reaching happiness, and this doesn't make much sense to the
right.
modern world.
Yeah. Definitely the case. Now, you mentioned in terms of measuring it, there are standard questions in the General Social Survey, which you've used to analyze this over time, and we'll come to your results here in a second. But again, how is that measured? How do we, if we want to understand if happiness is rising, if it's declining, if certain pockets of the population are happier than others, how do we go about finding that in that General Social Survey? What kind of questions get at that?
Well, the principal question that they've been asking, it's one of the core questions that they've asked since 1972 in the GSS, the General Social Survey, is the one I just mentioned. That is, I don't have the exact wording in front of me, but it's essentially the interviewer asks the respondent in general, how are you how do you feel these days, something to that,
mm-hmm.
and then the responses are very happy, pretty happy, or not too happy, and those are the three possible choices that the respondent is given. Now, that's, of course, what we would call a self-report measure.
Mm-hmm.
You're asking the person himself to indicate how he feels at this point, generally, there is considerable research that tries to and does a pretty good job of associating that with other measures that have a pretty strong validity, I think, in terms of a notion of what happiness is.
Mm-hmm.
Various behavioral kinds of things, references to persons, acquaintances, and so on. I mean, it says if you were, for instance, to ask about a friend of yours, would you say he's very happy? Or not too happy or something. In other words, you indicate some measure. That can be another measure that's used. And And research sometimes will correlate that and finds these self-reported measures to be pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
They're far from perfect, but we're used to that in the social sciences, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, we deal with it, and information is incomplete, and we can make the best use of what we have. One of the interesting questions, too, because you're using that general social survey question, and we're going to be talking about your research here in a second, but the question, as stated, says, ask the person, you know, how these days, mm-hmm. with this emphasis on, in the past couple weeks or month. Now, it doesn't explicitly say that, but mm-hmm. one can often imagine that a person that you call up to interview for the general social survey just, you know, spilled a boiling pot of spaghetti on their foot, and they're probably not feeling good right now. But in terms of adjusting that statistically, what you would see is that those errors would wash out over time. People who are just having a grumpy day that you call up is just going to be some random fluctuation. And so you're still getting a pretty good measure of the general population's level of happiness over time, right?
I think so. That's, of course, the issue of measurement error, which is always a problem for all these kinds of things. But I suspect we get a fairly good measurement of that.
Okay, now in the paper that we're going to be talking about specifically today, you're dealing with female happiness, though I'm probably guessing, and I may be incorrect on this, so please do correct me if I am wrong, that some of your findings are generalizable to the male population as well. Nonetheless, you're concentrating on this idea of female happiness because there's been an interesting trend in that area or in that measure over the past several decades since the 1972 when they started asking this question in the general social survey. What is that trend with female happiness?
Well, the data itself, of course, is on, we'll cover both males and females, and they're compared in this study of mine as well. Perhaps it's better to begin with a reference to the research that set me onto this. In 2009, a couple of professors at Wharton School, Stevenson and Wolfers, mm-hmm. did an interesting study in which they very carefully measured, both with the GSS and some other surveys. They tried to specify as precisely as possible the change in this self-reported happiness for both men and women over the about 3.5 decades since the GSS started, and they found that that the overall trend, although it jumps up a little up and down and so on various places, it's not certainly not a smooth or regular linear change over time, but the general pattern is such that at the beginning of the period of time, women began at a significantly higher level of self-reported happiness. And throughout those 35 years, they ended up being about the same level as males. In other words, they had declined in overall happiness, both relative to men and also in absolute terms.
Mm-hmm.
And this an interesting paper, an interesting piece of research that I think got quite a bit of play and interest by all sorts of sides and different perspectives. But it captured my attention as well, and I thought I'd take a look at it in other ways, because there were some other hunches I had about it that may have struck the original authors, and I just followed up on that. But it's an interesting pattern that in spite of the fact that we have a period of time where we think, well, women's condition has improved enormously, hasn't it, during that period of time?
And all the higher wages, more education, sure.
Exactly, and there are lots of objective measurements that show that. But in spite of that fact, these results are rather significant and indicate that it doesn't appear to have resulted in higher happiness for the women during that period. And so it's an interesting question. You think, well, what's going on here? What's happened? And as always the case, I think there's always something that doesn't immediately meet the eye, and you want to investigate a little bit further to mm-hmm. see what's going on.
And so the male happiness has remained relatively stable, or has that dipped a little
bit?
Well,
it jumped around. There is a diagram, a graph that I put in there that actually is an extension of what Stevenson and Wolfers did as well. I tried to use their methodology as much as possible because I was trying to replicate it with and then go on and do a little different analysis with it. And I had access to one more year of the General Social Survey than they did when they published it, because they'd done it a little earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But the trend was such that that at the beginning the females were clearly higher than the males, and females began to drop, and then both tended to increase during the 80s somewhat in the trend line, and then began to decline again, more or less together. But the higher level of the females, they lost that as mm-hmm. time went on, and again you can see that more clearly with the graph, which is a little bit difficult for us to do that right here directly with the podcast.
No, we'll present that a link to that in our website, so
yeah.
People can take a look for it. The paper is really written straightforward. One of the things I like about the IJRR is that the research is presented in ways that a wide range of scholars and also people outside of academia can read the research. One thing I should emphasize in looking at that chart right now, too, is you're not saying that women are less happy than men right now. It's just that women are still happier than men on average, but they've just declined in happiness much more rapidly than men. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think generally that's true. Again, we're measuring this as well as we can, and so we can't be terribly precise with it, but it does appear to be the case that women have dropped to a level approximately equal to men as measured by this particular question.
Now, in terms of this drop, too, oftentimes in social science research, we can pick up statistical significance, and that essentially means that we're noticing a difference that is not going to be caused by random error alone. But that is a little bit different than what we would term substantive significance, meaning that this difference really does make a difference. To what extent does this drop in female happiness really have a significant, noticeable impact, and it's not just some small statistical variation?
Well, that's a good question, of course, and that especially with the surveys and so on that we have big samples for, we'll often find statistical significance, but
mm-hmm.
but it's not necessarily the case that you're going to find any theoretical importance, and can in fact be just a trivial change. In fact, Stevenson Wolfers in that original article, I think they responded to that rather well. They were looking at various comparisons that one could draw
mm-hmm.
to evaluate the strength or the size of this decline in subjective well-being. I think it was an earlier study that Wolfers had done looking at the impact of unemployment on happiness. Now, that's something that I think we all can understand.
Mm-hmm, certainly.
I mean, as unemployment rises, yeah, happiness goes down. That makes good sense. And in one study he did, he did the various regression coefficients and so on, and calculated those and got some numerical estimates of that. And I took the same figures and just plugged them into the slight change in coefficients that I found in adding the extra year and so on. And found that in essence the decline for women relative to men over that period of time was equivalent to approximately an 8 percentage point rise in unemployment over that period of time.
Wow.
So I mean, if you were, for example, to say let's just, again, these are rough, but if you were to say that we begin with an unemployment rate of 4 and we rise to 12% unemployment, I say, well, what kind of a change in happiness are you likely to experience with that? Well, that change is roughly equal to this, of course, is a decrease in happiness, obviously, but that change in happiness is equivalent to approximately what women experience relative to men over that period of time,
yeah.
And that gives a pretty good sense of the substantive significance of that decline. So we're not talking about something that's trivial, I think, here.
Right. Now, that was a very powerful aspect of your paper, to put that decline in happiness in terms of the rise in unemployment, because now in the economic hard times that we're feeling, we haven't witnessed an 8% increase in unemployment, but it's still been very steep. And I know many people around me are very nervous and stressed out and tense, and so one can understand that the decline in female happiness from 1972 till roughly today is equivalent to that and possibly a little bit more, really shines the light on, you know, that this has been a substantively significant drop in the past few decades. Let me back up here now and perhaps ask a question about happiness from a different angle. I know there's been a lot of research here on happiness itself. In terms of the general literature, and before we get into the issue of religion here, what factors do other scholars find associated with happiness? In essence, what makes us happy? Or alternatively, what makes us unhappy?
Well, I think it's helpful to begin with a general theoretical approach to it, just a framework to help us clarify this. At least this is what I like to do, looking at the whole area. And we see in terms of the needs of the human person. I mean, what are things that we desire? Because again, in happiness, we're talking about happiness as possessing the good, and philosophers will often define it something in terms of that. Well, what is it that we desire to possess, and what's important to us? And again, we're not that these would include various material things, certainly. But I think if you look carefully and at what we know, both certainly from philosophy, but also from the social and psychological sciences, and just general observation of each other and in our social settings and so on. Certainly, very important in that is the need to have close, lasting relationships, this is something we see so important, and it's really part of our nature. And I think we can understand that as an essential component of the human person, that being in relationship to others, and I don't mean simply an acquaintance. I mean a pattern in which we have close personal ties that last and that can give us a sense of meaning and purpose and so on in life. And certainly that's extremely important, and the literature certainly backs that up as well. It shows in all sorts of ways that when we have these close relationships that last and that we can count on, that we build in trust and a sense of meaning and purpose, people do tend to be happy. And this is, of course, even the case when we may materially be wanting in one way or another. Mm-hmm. Now, again, in terms of from the religious perspective, this is extremely important because, right, of course, as Christians understand it very well, this idea of relationality and an intimate and personal relationship is the essence of our relationship with God Himself, and that's, of course, what's provided with that. And of course, theologically, there's wonderful development of this whole area. We could certainly talk about it a little bit, but I think that's a key aspect of looking at happiness, and so that looking for evidence and indications of the strengthening or the maintenance of these relationships, I think we see that those are factors that have a tremendous impact on the happiness of the person, the human person.
Before getting into some of the religious factors that play into happiness, I want to talk about some more of the secular things and about the literature. Are there any other types of things that might affect happiness, like levels of education, or are there possibly certain ethnic groups or racial categories that experience greater happiness than others?
Well, if you look at we can simply look at some of the associations that are found and issues of education, generally education to promote happiness. I mean, these are, again, far from perfect relationships, but that tends to be the case. Racial categories, at least in American data, American blacks tend to be lower in happiness in these self-reported measures, even also, in fact, controlling for other socioeconomic factors. And as I said, mentioned before, again, generally females do tend to have somewhat higher happiness, just as a general level, I'm not talking about the trend.
Mm-hmm.
But there are several of these kinds of what you might call demographic kinds of variables that appear to be related reasonably strongly.
And let's talk about that decline in female the trend line from 1972 to roughly present time. And you had mentioned the work of Steverson and Wolfer dealing with this topic. Mm-hmm. What did they associate with this decline in female happiness?
Well, they speculated about a number of things, and that really is, they were not, in fact, trying to tease out terribly carefully the reason for this. They were attempting to specify precisely that it had occurred.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that's a very interesting question. About why has this occurred? And again, we're going to do this rather speculatively, but you can't help it because it's a very interesting question, isn't
mm-hmm.
it? But the changes, the social changes, and that's naturally what a sociologist is going to look at that, isn't he? So, but the social changes that have occurred over the last 3.5-4 decades are very significant, especially with respect to the relationship between men and women. And it's hard to avoid these are some of the factors that have brought that change about. Demonstrating it clearly empirically is a whole other question, of course. That's a tough one. But if we think about that, I mean, think about the different issues, the different things, the different ways that that men and women relate, and the greater participation of women in various areas that have not been the case, and particularly, I think, is important is the additional expectations placed on women that make their pursuit of things that naturally they will desire.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, more difficult, and I think that's an area that's worth exploring more.
Yeah, I think about the increase in the female population, the workforce, many career women
mm-hmm.
moving through the ranks of the corporate ladder and such,
mm-hmm.
And yet still, there's an expectation that they're in charge of the home, and so this could put additional time pressures and burdens on them. And in terms of relationships, too, I mean, that's very difficult. I know, you know, when my wife and I are very busy and running around our kids and to baseball and to basketball and all that, we don't have as much time together, and that can be very stressful and lead to unhappiness, I can imagine.
Right, right, yeah.
Let me go ahead and not to take a cheap shot at the psychological profession here, but you know, as I was reading your paper, it seems that from the early 1970s until present, there's really been a growth in psychological services, especially secular psychological services, that I think in many ways seem to manufacture some degree of unhappiness. I mean, we often think about advertising as creating expectations that are very difficult to satiate, to meet. But, you know, is there an unhappiness industrial complex that, you know, preys on people that, oh, you need Prozac because you're not happy, and people start thinking, maybe I am not happy? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you're probably right, and there are people who, of course, comment on that issue. I'm thinking of who's the work? Is it Philip Cushman, in Empty Self? I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he points to points to advertising and psychotherapy explicitly as two, we might call them, institutions that have in some cases created much of this, or at least provided I think it's a matter of that through advertising and through psychotherapy, the empty self has been attempted to be filled.
Mm-hmm.
It's not putting it quite as well as I'd like to put it, but there is almost a manufactured need that we see, that it's created and replaces something certainly more authentic in many cases. So.
Yeah, it almost seems to be some of a self-fulfilling prophecy in there, or it may be a chicken and an egg problem in terms of social science methodology of figuring this out, is that if you see a decline in female happiness, then there's more attention paid to it, and then as more attention is paid to it, people start reflecting upon this, saying, oh, I really might not be that happy at all. And one of the things I just noticed, and again, reading through your paper, this came to me, was that a lot of the advertising on television or in newspapers or magazines about psychological services often tend to be aimed at women,
mm-hmm.
which is fascinating and possibly another fascinating trend of research to see if that's the case. Let's turn to the issue of religion now. And one of the great observations that you made was that in previous research in trying to explain this trend in female unhappiness and just happiness in general, the issue of religion was largely neglected. It wasn't put in as a variable. And we've had other people on the podcast here that have noted similar things. Jeff Levin has noted this, that in the field of health services, people never thought religion or spirituality would have an impact on one's health. And in terms of juvenile delinquency, we had Byron Johnson on talking about how many scholars neglected the church factor in this and, you know, picked up on this. So I think you properly called attention to this and say, whoa, some of these earlier scholars are not really looking at this church factor. So what brought you to think about that, and what did you find in relation to religion?
Well, I suppose in terms of the response to the what brought me to that is that when one does use social science, when we do our work as social scientists, we're going to be attracted to problems and examine them from a perspective that appeals to us, makes sense to us in terms of our worldview,
mm-hmm.
The things that we hold to be important in the primary in terms of the nature of who we are as creatures. And the understanding of the nature of the human person for me is illuminated very, very importantly by the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's no matter what perspective you're coming from, you're going to come from some kind of you're going to have some kind of perspective on who man is, what is the human person, what is he about, why is he here, and so on. These important kinds of philosophical questions. These are not scientific questions, or at least they're not questions that can be answered by science. But they're important because they provide the foundation for our work. And so, I'm a Catholic. I understand. I look at the world, I think, through that idea, through those lenses, so to speak. And so when I do sociology, I'm doing it from that perspective. The problems that are interesting to me are interesting because they are somehow illuminated in a way that that makes sense and provides interest for me there. So as I look at this, or as I was looking at this idea, this trending, this trend pattern in female happiness, it naturally occurred to me that there are some things that are important here that may be missing. And church attendance is readily measurable. I mean, it's not always we do it terribly accurately, but because it's not the simplest thing in the world to measure, but it's fairly straightforward. And it taps something very, very important to us. At least someone from a Christian perspective would understand that it's important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason that we often don't have as much reference to it in the as you were saying, the secular literature, so to speak, or in the scientific literature, is because it doesn't strike some people as being important.
Right.
I think the idea that it's not important is false, because you observe people. I don't mean that everyone is religious or explicitly follows this in any particular pattern, but in general, it's far more important than the media, for example, will indicate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of the certainly in academic circles, you're going to have a greater likelihood of people ignoring it because it's not important to them, and so they assume or don't even it doesn't it's not even really on their radar, so to speak. But it is for me, and I suspect, I'm sure it is for you as well, Tony, and probably people who do research in this area generally. And so it certainly occurred to me that it was a factor that might be important.
Now, when you take a look at this factor, you break it down into two separate elements, some of which we've touched on implicitly earlier on in this podcast here. And I thought this was a fascinating way of really linking the mechanism of religiosity to happiness. It's not just simple, you walk into church and you're happy. You talk about transcendental meaning, and then you also talk about the issue of personal ties or relationships there. So how do those two mechanisms work to enhance happiness?
Well, I think the literature, as you read the work here that's going on and the theoretical explanations and so on, I think those two elements emerge rather clearly. That if you look again at church attendance, what's going on there? Certainly, what we were talking about earlier, in terms of the importance of social ties and these relationships that give meaning to life and so on, that is clearly an important part of what's going on in church attendance, because that relationality, those patterns of relationships are very important within that, and it's an explicit part of that.
Yeah, every Sunday you see the same people. You have a chance to meet with them in the foyer, and oftentimes it extends beyond Sunday. You have Bible study groups. Sunday says, come by Wednesday, we're going to have a Bible study group, and you start, and many churches, as we've talked on previous podcasts, have the notion of small groups, that even if you're at a big church, which might seem rather impersonal, you break down into groups of 15, 20, 25, individuals and form a smaller community within there.
That's right, and I think that development of that small group methodology is a recognition of this, that of the importance of these ties, these social ties. But on the other hand, also an important need, I didn't mention this before, but I think listeners would understand it as well, all of us would, again, a need of the human person is to find meaning in life, something beyond oneself. The search for, I think you were using the word transcendent meaning before, that's exactly what we're talking about here.
And it's actually your term, so I actually found that to be a very useful term in thinking about that, because if you think about happiness and the concept of happiness in the long term, as we were talking about at the beginning of the podcast, about joy or some long-standing contentment in life, knowing that there is some greater meaning to life, that there is somebody walking the path with you, that Jesus or God is looking after you, it really, I think, provides some contentment even in the most difficult times of life, and would temper some of the stress and unhappiness that you might have in economic hard times.
Well, I think you're right. It has a like you phrased it, tempering that unhappiness. It has that protective effect in that sense, but it also it's a positive benefit as well. So not only is it trying to help you get over the bumps in the road, but it's a reason for being on the road.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reason for living, and a reason for it's also, I think, it provides us a way to see the beauty and the goodness of life that we would otherwise miss. And that's what brings joy, I think, to people. They get a real happiness to people. And you see both of those aspects, I think, in church attendance. Again, so often in social science research, we're measuring these things so crudely. But I think that you're picking up both of those aspects. In fact, in the paper too, I try to do a really rough estimate of these two aspects in terms of church attendance, and I came up with I emphasize it's very rough, but it appears it may be half and half here. In other words, it's at least you got about half of the issue is a spiritual a meaning and transcendent meaning, and half of it is the close personal ties. I think both of those things are involved.
No, actually, you say it's very rough. Actually, I thought it was a very clever and interesting way of getting at those two different aspects when the data is sometimes difficult to figure out and what is going on there, and you use the issue of prayer as a way of getting at that. We'll come back to that in a second, but the issue of religious attendance and getting back to the drop in female happiness since the early 1970s, you make mention, or you notice, based upon other research, that there has been a decline in religious attendance over the past 3-4 decades. It is somewhat leveled off in the past decade or so. Mm-hmm. And how is that, in terms of what your research found, how is that directly linked, if at all, to the decline in female happiness? What's going on there between decline in church attendance and decline in female unhappiness?
Well, in one of the, I would say really this is probably the key thing that guided the original hunch that I had, the original hypothesis when I began to look at it, is the idea that, again, I was aware that there had been some decline. I mean, we can see it around us as well as looking at the literature as well. Although I think you are right that that decline seems to have certainly tapered off, but over this 3.5 decades, I think it's really quite clear that there has been a decline. If in fact, if it's the case as I had supposed, and that church attendance is a promoter of happiness, and there's quite a bit of literature that backs that up as well, then one would expect that with a decline in church attendance, one ought to have a decline in happiness. And that's just that's a fairly simple approach to it, and that's really what guided me originally. I think, well, what do we have here? Is the reason that the happiness was declining was because people stopped attending church? I didn't really think it was quite as simple as that, but that was the that's what originally guided me on that. And in fact, I found some evidence for that, because if you have essentially what you'd call a mediating factor here, that if you control for that, then the original relationship ought to decline in some fashion. You look at this statistically, but essentially found that, yes, in fact, that relationship does appear to decline considerably when you eliminate the effect of changing mm-hmm. church attendance.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating how you went about and did that, because you could take a look at just the social correlation, say, oh, declining drop in attendance and then declining happiness, just line those two lines up and say, well, that happens to be the case. You're actually parsing this out a little bit more accurately to make sure that it's not just a spurious correlation. You're using each of the individuals within the general social survey and matching up to what extent are they happy, to what extent do they go to church. And you break down the church service in terms of different categories here that, you know, go less than once a year or never. They go a couple times a year and a couple times a month, and then finally weekly. And how does that break down in terms of your research and what you find?
Well, the by controlling for that attendance, that original relationship between, the trend, the overall trend for females drops out quite a bit. It really almost disappears entirely, which suggests that indeed the attendance has something very important to. Has an important effect on all of this, but then examining, this is what I took a look a little more on this, because it didn't disappear entirely, but it greatly weakened. So, well, what's going on? So I wanted to explore this a little more detail, and that's when I pulled out those four attendance groups that you just described, and looked at them separately in terms of the trends. And there it was interesting. I found that it was only it was only for women who virtually never attended, rarely or never attended, where you retained a significant decline over the period in happiness, which I found really quite interesting, and led to some. I think that leads to some interesting possibilities here as well in terms of explanation.
There does not necessarily need to be at church 5 times a week to be happy, but what it does seem to suggest is that you have to somehow get connected with a church in some way or another.
And of course, I mean, this is an indicator of a lot of things. I mean, we use these indicators because this is what we can measure, mm-hmm. and yet clearly the attendance at church, I mean, someone who goes to church weekly, I mean, yeah, okay, he's going to church weekly, but there are all sorts of other things that are different about him than those who rarely attend. So it's a whole complex of of attitudes and behaviors and those factors that are going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we can't measure them all very well. Or some cases we can't measure them at all. But we do our best with that. And this church attendance is picking up some things, I think, that are very important.
What about the issue of prayer? You threw in a variable that asked people how often they prayed and what, I mean, that's another way of, I think, connecting with transcendent meaning.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who don't go to church but may pray on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not surprisingly, we find out that regular prayer tends to be correlated fairly highly with regular church attendance, though it's not
right.
Perfect. But what do you find in terms of prayer? Does prayer help to ameliorate some of the decline in happiness?
Well, in that section of the paper, what I was trying to do, again, is get a little sense of parsing out what was going on with church attendance. But when I included both prayer and church attendance in the regression, I found that the effect of prayer dropped out altogether. I mean, just there wasn't anything there left.
Yeah.
And that suggested to me that whatever is in prayer, in terms of, again, these latent factors we're talking about that can't measure very well, whatever is in prayer is more powerfully in attendance, plus there's some other stuff there as well. And I think, you know, it seems to me that reflects an important factor. I mean, we talk about religion, we talk about spirituality, and of course there's a big issue about these kinds of things, and there's all sorts of spirituality out there. And some of it has real content, and some of it's really connected to factors in people's lives that really make a difference, and as I say, have some connection with a true commitment by the person. But sometimes there's not a lot of substance to it as well. And I think the advantage of looking at a variable like attendance, church attendance, is you've got a specific behavior that you can't fudge much.
Right.
You can't play around with it. You can't. And of course, the very term religion, as Tony, I'm sure you know. I mean, again, it's connected linguistically and so on with bind, the binding.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just something I invent. There's a rule there. There's a substance that's beyond myself. Whereas in spirituality, and sometimes, of course, in what we call prayer, that can be something that's not really connected to much.
Yeah.
So when we ask someone whether he prays or not, that may be very, very substantial, because, of course, there are people whose prayer is very, very powerful and very meaningful, and there are others who say they're praying, but, again, obviously, you know, it's not a judgmental thing I'm talking about here. I'm just saying in terms of its reality in their lives,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be probably something that doesn't have much, many teeth to it, you might say.
Yeah, it's before any of my final exams, I see students walking in praying that they're going to do a pretty good job on the exam.
Oh, right.
Yes, it can be loose like that. Actually, I like that aspect of the paper where you did compare the issue of prayer with the issue of attendance, and for me that really brought home the communal aspect of religion being so absolutely important. And in today's modern world, we talk a lot about people saying, oh, religion's a really private thing to me, I do it on my own. We're finding out that might not necessarily be the case, that we do need those linkages with other individuals that either, you know, enhance our happiness through social context, or in many ways, I think, enhance the transcendental meaning of religion. When I'm involved in a group in some kind of religious activity, there is something greater than the sum of its parts that you do experience in that regard.
Yeah, I think that's very true. You know, in American society, we are such individualists, and so I think we've fallen into that idea of private religion. And I don't think we readily admit it very often, but if it's entirely private religion, there's probably not a whole lot to it.
So let me really switch gears a little bit and allow you to do a little bit of speculation with the time that we have left. Your research does find that religious attendance, getting together at religious services on a regular basis, really does help to enhance happiness. You know, kind of doing this from the flip side, you're seeing that people who drop out of that network of religious experience tend to be or tend to experience greater drops in unhappiness. But from a perspective of social psychology or from the psychological, clinical psychological perspective, and again, I know you're a sociologist, but you are affiliated with a school that does a lot of training in clinical psychology. How does one work these results that you find into some kind of policy-oriented, it doesn't necessarily have to be governmental policy-oriented, but how can psychologists make use of these findings?
Oh, I think these are very important for psychologists. And I've talked with my colleagues about this, and in fact, in the social psychology class that I teach, I'm teaching clinical psychology, or training, I'm sorry, there. These are clinical psychologists in training, mm-hmm. and we touch on a lot of these and examine these in detail, a lot of these issues, and I think they're very important for good clinical psychology, because you understand, or rather you must understand, I think, that that as I was saying before, the human person is a social being,
mm-hmm.
and he's connected. I mean, it's his very nature; it's the way we're created. I mean, we understand that as Christians. But I think we should understand these as social this is social scientists too, that we're created as social beings, and in that social context, it has tremendous effect on everything about us. It affects our cognitive, affective, our volitional, all sorts of elements of ourselves, who we are, what we do, what we desire, and I think as a clinical psychologist, you want to help your patient to heal and to flourish, and a very important aspect of that is to help him to enter into patterns of relationships that are supportive of that will strengthen his virtue, strengthen his ability, his freedom to truly to pursue the true good
mm-hmm.
for himself. And I mean, because that's really what happiness, I think, is about. We pursue and possess the good, but we often don't know what that good is. We get sidetracked. We come across or get fooled by what we're told we ought to want, what we ought to desire, and we go off on detours and very dangerous ones as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think a clinical psychologist working with a patient. Can and the good ones do in fact use it. It's that they'll attempt to help the person build relationships
mm-hmm.
with others that will help that patient to grow in virtue and to grow towards goodness and have greater freedom. And that's in fact what we do so much at IPS. That's really the perspective that we take.
Yeah, I do want to. I want to talk a little bit more about IPS here in a second, though. But you know, I'm fascinated, being that I'm at a public university. That's where my primary home is. I'm also affiliated with Baylor University, a religious university. You understand the social linkages, the connections with others are very important for psychologists to emphasize for individuals as a way of finding greater mental health or improving mental health. But it must be hard for psychologists at a secular institution like the University of Washington or, say, the University of Michigan to say, hey, you need to go get connected to a church, because those are the places that relationships really build strong. I mean, traditionally, throughout history, we find relationship building going on in churches all the time. So,
uh-huh.
I mean, that's got to be fairly difficult for the secular psychological world, and they're probably somewhat resistant to the, you know, take a couple masses and then call me next month.
Right. Well, of course, that makes it a little too much like, you know, like taking a pill, and it's far more. There's a lot more to it than that.
That's true. Yeah.
But I don't know. I understand what you're saying, and clearly it's often perceived to be inappropriate. But I think if we take the perspective again, let's take your assumption, your framework here that you've got somebody working at a public university
mm-hmm.
in psychology. Or even just in some sort of a secular setting, not an explicitly religious setting. I think it's very consistent with the ethics of the field of psychology, of clinical psychology, for an individual to offer that as an option if it appears appropriate. I mean, you certainly do not impose this,
right?
Because of course, again, we understand within Christian faith that 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 religion needs to be accepted in freedom. I mean, the person has to be free to do so or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so imposing it on one is actually dangerous, is counterproductive and dangerous. So, but as an option, it certainly ought to be accepted. Now, of course, there are times when there's such animosity towards religion that it becomes it's excluded just from the start. But that, of course, is an intolerance that is totally unacceptable.
Yeah.
But we do run into it. You're right.
Right. No, that's true. And when I mentioned take a couple of masses and call me in the morning, there does seem, in many ways, in the psychological profession, try to find quick bullet answers to things, especially the rise of Prozac, and you can cure your happiness with a pill or something like that. But what you're talking about is really a range of options and a long-term commitment to seeking out relationships and on the side as well, transcendental meaning for things. That brings me to the final minutes here that we have to talk a little bit about what you folks are doing at the Institute for Psychological Sciences. Now, this is affiliated with the Catholic Church, and what is the this is the one of the, when I read your paper, this is the first that I ever heard of this institute. Tell us a little bit about what your general philosophy is there at that institute.
Well, interestingly enough, it fits fairly well what we're talking about here, because the institute really is an attempt to develop a psychology, or develop psychology in such a way that it promotes the flourishing of the human person, and that really means the happiness of the person. So I think it fits rather well to what we're talking about in this context. IPS is I guess we're 11 years old now, just in our 10th year anniversary we celebrated last year.
So relatively new.
It's quite new. We have managed to just this past year we got our full renewal accreditation from the big regional group. That's what is SACS, is the one that we have down in the southern United States.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Tony, who you all what regional group you have, but of course it's more important for us in the sense that we're a new institution. But we were successful with that, and we've had lots of great successes. But it's a small institute. We have about 70 students, graduate students now, and but it's based it's founded really essentially on what you would call a philosophical foundation of Catholic teaching in terms of what is the nature of the human person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who are we, and the full truth of that serves as a foundation for the psychology that we do. Now, I think I mentioned it before, that, I mean, these are really philosophical, in some cases theological issues, and they're not science itself. But any kind of science, certainly any social science that we do, is always going to be founded on a set of philosophical or metaphysical assumptions about the nature of reality. And especially if it's a social or a human science, it's going to be founded on metaphysical assumptions about who we are as creatures. What are we?
Mm-hmm.
And based on how you answer those kinds of questions, you're going to do something very different. And a lot of the mainstream psychology is based on an entirely different view of who the human person is. And they may use the same techniques, and our students all learn the good, effective techniques. They're very fine psychologists. They learn the field very well, but they base that knowledge, that training on what is often a different metaphysical assumption about reality, and about, especially about the reality of the human person, than is often taught at a lot of the mainstream programs in psychology.
Now, you say you have about 70 or so graduate students there. Are most of these folks going into the clinical psychology profession, or is there an academic?
They're going to some avenue of it, element of it. We offer both master's degrees and a PsyD, which is the clinical doctorate. Not all the students go on to the clinical doctorate, which of course is typically that's obviously common in any graduate school.
Uh-huh.
And so the ones who finish the PsyD will go on to the full-fledged clinical psychology and be licensed in some parts of the world, wherever they're going.
Mm-hmm.
But the masters as well will get most of them will pursue work in some area of psychology, counseling, something of that sort. But they do it, and they go really with a again, with a background and a foundation that is very is obviously very attractive to those who are who recognize the truth of the Christian understanding of the world, because frankly, some psychological training and certainly psychologists who are trained in other programs sometimes, of course, will take their patients in directions that are quite opposed to the Christian understanding of the world, and I think we may all have examples of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will provide a link to the IPS on our website as well for anybody interested in attending graduate school there. They can check it out, or just for the general public to see what new and interesting trends are occurring within the academic field. Again, that you are 10, 11 years old here, and you know, in a world that we oftentimes feel is rapidly secularizing, this is really a wonderful trend to see. So, folks, we encourage you to check that out, as well as the research paper here by Professor Ross. And Alex, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion today.
Thank you very much, Tony. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.